Welcome to Make It Rain, hosted by me, Josh Smith. I'm a journalist and presenter, and I've been lucky enough to sit down and have unfiltered conversations with some truly incredible people. I know from my own personal experiences how powerful talking and crucially listening to others is. And without a doubt, my life has been changed by the people I've spoken to over the years, some of whom you'll hear from in this very series. I am so excited to invite you to join me each week to meet amazing queens who have overcome challenges in their own lives. They're open up about their journey they've been on to harness their power and wear their crowns with pride. I really hope you'll feel empowered to own your own story and make it rain in your own lives too. In this episode of Make It Rain, we are joined by Derry Girls and Bridgerton babe, Nicola Coughlan. Now, Nicola's road to Netflix stardom has not been without its challenges. She was forced to move back home to Ireland from London, and she was working in opticians before she saw a casting call on Twitter for the play Jess and Joe Forever. She won the title role of Jess and soon landed her role in Channel 4 comedy Derry Girls, which I was obsessed with. During our chat, Nicola talks candidly about what success and failure means to her, allyship, and that Penelope Featherington Bridgerton plot twist. There is so much amazing wisdom about defining success on your own terms, and I'm so excited for you queens to hear it. So crowns at the ready! Well, hello, babe.
Hello, love. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I mean, yours is just such a lovely face to see at the beginning of 2021. It's that lovely smile.
I was going to say that right back to you because, to be honest, I first found love for you when I saw you in Derry Girls as the wee lesbian Claire. And I was just
Claire
like...
Evelyn?
That is just like galaxy in my ear when you use that accent. What do you think? Like, that role was so amazing for you and it kind of projected you on this journey that you're now on, right? But what did that role teach you about the idea of sisterhood? Because the sisterhood on that set is so amazing, isn't it? What did it teach you about that concept?
Well, it bounced off the script straight away. It's like you get a script like that. I'd never seen young girls written that way, in a way that they could be so outspoken and so supportive of each other, but at the same time were complicated and, you know, in some ways unlikable, could, you know, do things that you kind of go, oh Jesus. And I found that really refreshing. And then being in that group of the five of us is a really special thing, because I think, you know, the relationship you have with other actors is what makes the work, you know, that way that you can bounce off one another. But to be in a group of five and have that, the ability to sort of, you know, have a tandem with one another and bounce the ball back and forth, that's a really rare thing. So it was very special. And I think all those female characters written so distinctively, and it's just a very special thing. I love the show so much. I actually was rewatching it with my mom last night. I hadn't seen it for quite a while, and my mom was like, it's playing on E4, and sometimes I'm like not in the mood to watch myself, and I'm like, but last night I thought, oh, go on, I will. And I was watching going, this is brilliant, this is so funny. Like, I was probably cracking up. I was like, this is a great bloody show.
Well, it's good you can laugh at yourself, babe. I think that's good. Well, and enjoy your performance.
It takes time. I mean, the first time I ever watch myself in anything, it's like painful. I'm like, oh, why did I do that? Okay, if I could go back, I would make this different acting choice. And then I have to like get over myself, and then I can enjoy the full show.
What do you think that role also taught you about the concept of allyship as well, from playing a queer character, I guess? What did that teach you, would you say? Because you're very much an ally in your own right anyway. But what did it kind of like more compound about that idea?
It felt incredibly important to, I think if you're ever, you know, taking on a role as, you know, a gay character, I didn't want to take it, and knowing what, you know, the representation means to people and, you know, people seeing themselves reflected on screen, I didn't want to take that and not sort of do anything with it, if that makes sense. So I kind of was like, I feel like I need to be like a pointedly active ally within Northern Ireland, because I'm from the Republic of Ireland, and I, you know, did campaigning for, you know, marriage equality and things like that at home. But then in Northern Ireland, you know, at the time we were filming season one, you know, equal marriage was not a reality in Northern Ireland, and I went to like a queer arts festival in Belfast, and they were talking about how, you know, queer people there are still treated like second class citizens. So I made a point to visit this charity called the Rainbow Project and, you know, sit down and say, like, what's the situation like here and how do you find it? And, you know, and thinking about, you know, Claire Devlin still couldn't have gotten married in Northern Ireland up until last year, which is awful. Mm. And then meeting, you know, members of the trans community in Northern Ireland and talking to them about, you know, how they're represented in the media and how people, you know, speak about them. And, you know, I think in those situations, like having understanding and opening up your mind and going like, I don't know this, but can you tell me, you're the expert, and just saying I'm here for you and I'll stand with you. That felt very important to me to do that.
What kind of stories did you hear that really stuck with you during that experience?
I think one thing that really stuck with me is just, you know, everyone is just a person trying to live their own life. Everyone's just trying to live their truth and do what they can do. And how much, you know, I feel like as human beings, it's interesting because we've just taken to social media. We've just, you know, we act like social media has just been our way of life always. It hasn't been, you know, and I'm totally guilty of it. And then I spend all the time scrolling on Instagram or whatever. But seeing how much, you know, hate can amplify on social media. And how much, you know, when one loud voice and one recognizable voice can say a negative thing, how much impact that has on people's real lives and how they are treated by other people. Because, you know, I think especially Twitter, that's a medium in which you're publishing things. You've put that out there and that is attributed to you. And, you know, there's a paper trail of what you said and you need to be super careful the impact that can have on somebody. And I think when you sit down face to face with someone and say, what, you know, what's going on and how does this feel? You know, it just, I think we should all have more empathy, you know, in general in life. But when you see these things can really hurt people and make their lives day to day harder to live, that just really stuck with me. So whenever I see people sort of, saying stuff online, I think, no, you don't know that's affecting a real human being, not just one, many.
Yeah. And I mean, I just don't understand how we aren't all just living lives as empathetic people. That's
100%,
what I, the concept is just so simple. Like, just empathize with someone else's situation. If it doesn't affect you, then just move on. Like, literally, yeah, I've never understood that need to take people down in any respect.
No, and I think it shows a certain closed-mindedness. And I think the more people that you meet and encounter in your life, the more empathy you will have. And I think we have to learn to challenge our, you know, everyone grows up with a certain set of ideals and morals or what have you. But I think we can't remain within that bubble. We have to open ourselves out. Like even, I suppose, this year with, you know, Black Lives Matter and all of this, I grew up in a super white country, not knowing so much about Black culture. And, you know, partly for years I would go, well, you know, I never, you know, I've never said anything negative and I've never, you know, and I would be open to everything. But then you think, but that is that enough? It's not really enough. It's about knowing the struggles that people go through and seeing what they face. And I think, you know, I think in life we should never really stop learning or stop, you know, and situations change. And this year's brought that into such stark reality of what people are going through. So I think, yeah, the more empathy we can have and the more that we take responsibility for opening our minds and being understanding, the better off we will be, really.
And I think we've all had that moment of sitting with ourselves in the last year, right? Where you actually have to sit with yourself and you're like, who am I as a person? Is this part of me actually something I need to get rid of? Like, having that introspection has been kind of amazing, hasn't it, in some ways? That's kind of one of the positives to come out of this situation. What have you learned from sitting with yourself, do you think?
Oh gosh, at the beginning I found lockdown really tough because I like to be busy. I'm like the same as you. We're like busy queens. We're like, let's go, we'll do this. And then when that stops, you go like, oh God, okay, what am I when I'm not working and what am I when I'm not? And I think I've been quite lucky, and I've been lucky in the sense that like I've been healthy and my family have been healthy, and that's, you know, primarily important above anything else this year, because people have gone through absolute hell. It's just unfathomable what some people have had to deal with. So I consider myself one of the very, very lucky ones. But I've been lucky in that, you know, Bridgerton was the filming was super, super busy and we were on the road a lot and we filmed in these stunning houses, but it involved a lot of traveling and a lot of being away from my family. So I had the privilege of being around my family a lot this last year, which, you know, I normally wouldn't do because I kind of, you know, as an actor, you're a freelancer and a lot of people don't think of it like that, but you are.
Yeah.
So you don't know, you know, when your next job will be, where it will take you. So I think I just had to say to myself, like, take this time and appreciate that you can spend it with your family and, you know, just try and, yeah, count yourself lucky. Not that I didn't have days where I was like a little whingy baby. Of course I did. But, you know, I tried to like balance that out.
Yeah. You got to balance being grateful with a whingy baby. Like, it's
It's
got to be a discussion between the two. Like, I mean, everyone has fallen in love with you as Penelope Featherington in Bridgerton. And drum roll, please. It's been watched by more than 63 million households in the first 28 days. And it's making it Netflix's fifth biggest original series launch of all time. And the facts are still coming, babe. Bridgerton has reached number one overall in 76 countries, including US, UK, Brazil, France, and South Africa. Babe, how mad
it's mad.
Are those stats? How's that been? How has it been navigating that success?
I mean, it's truly bizarre because I think I, you know, come from having to hustle in this industry to kind of get noticed and having, you know, doing fringe plays where you're like, you know, is anyone going to come see it? And if, you know, you get more than 20 people in the audience, it's a big success because you worked your ass off for it.
Yeah.
So I think I very much still live in that mentality in a way. So like before Bridgerton came out, I knew it was going out on the biggest streaming service in the world on Christmas Day, but there was still the part of me that went, is anyone going to watch this? And what I need to get people to watch it, and I need to, like, I just had that. So on Christmas Day, I was like, no one has watched this. No one will watch this show. Like, I just fully, like, had a moment where I was like, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. I've dedicated a year and a half of my life to it, and I know hundreds of people put in, you know, so many, you know, months of their life into it, but it's fine. No one will watch it, and I've just accepted that. And then, you know, on, we call Boxing Day Stephen's Day in Ireland. So on Stephen's Day then, it just sort of started taking off, and you know, people were sending me messages being like, it's number one in South Africa, it's number one in Canada, it's number one in India, it's number one. And then I started, you know, people were sending them to me, so I started just compiling a list on Twitter to sort of just try and, because it's so intangible, I suppose, at the moment, because, you know, we're in full lockdown here, so it's literally like everything is just, I'm stuck at home with my mom, not doing anything. So when people would send me those messages, you're going, okay, I guess people are watching it in you know, Pakistan. Okay, I get but it's I don't know. Yeah, it's strange. And I've been talking to some of my other castmates, like Phoebe Dinnever, who's just such a doll and a sweetheart. Yeah, she is. And you know, I'm so thrilled for like so many of the other people involved in the show. And Phoebe, she just handle that role with such grace, and she's just, yeah, she's such a true professional. And but yeah, talking to them, and I'm going, what's going on? Like, this is mad, isn't it? Like, these numbers, like 63 million, like, it doesn't make any sense to me, I think.
Yeah,
you know, I get that it's a number, but I don't think I could even write it. Like, I'm like, what?
But I mean, it gives us everything from Balls to Gossip to Julie Andrews to costume drama. I mean, it's everything. What for you was the biggest pinch me moment on set, would you say?
The pinch me moments were daily. They were just like many, many things. From first being cast, I mean, when the script sort of came through to my agent, I had been sort of, it was a period of a lot of rejection, which is totally normal. Can I just put that out there? Because I think not enough actors talk about that and go, yeah, I was rejected for a bunch of jobs. That is totally par for the course. We shouldn't pretend that it's not.
Yeah.
But I mean, there was a point that I was feeling super sorry for myself and going, well, I'll never work again then. That's fine. That's fine. I'll give up on my dreams and it's fine. And I'll have to go back and work in retail. And I did already worked in retail for many years, so I shouldn't have to go back and all of these things. And then my agent said, you know, Shondalander making a show with Netflix. So for me, I was like, well, that's going to be a massive deal, obviously. But I thought that audition process is going to be awful. Surely it's going to be awful because, you know, it's America and you hear about, you know, executives and this and, you know, going in and out and chemistry reading with people. And I thought, oh God, okay. And I thought, well, what happened is I'll do one audition, I'll never hear back. So I did one audition with the casting assistant, Cole Edwards, and the tape went off to America. And I thought, okay, bye to that forever. And then I got a call 2 weeks later offering me the part. And I went, whoa, whoa, whoa. And sort of couldn't really take it in. And I thought, how, why? And then, you know, I finally met our showrunner, Chris Van Dusen. And I said to him, like, in a nice way, but what were you thinking hiring me? Like, it's, you know, when you've never met someone, I haven't read with anybody, I haven't, you know, just wondered why. And he said, well, your tape came in and Shonda and I sat down and she turned to me and said, well, it has to be her. And I mean,
Shonda Rhimes, her brother went, it has to be her.
Yeah. And I just sort of went, so that was probably like a huge one. And then Julie Andrews obviously had a full meltdown when I found that out. That was another one, you know, thing. I'm going to be in a show with Julie Andrews. Oh my God. I mean, going in, you know, for the costume fittings and realizing this wasn't, you know, your local Amdram production, you know, the costume fittings being like 4 or 5 hours, you know, everything was completely couture and there was, you know, rooms where people were hand embellishing flowers, they were dyeing shoes to match dresses, and they made 7,500 pieces of costume for this show.
Babes, the stats just keep coming.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. If we ever get to bring you down to the costume warehouse, it's total fairy tale land. But it's also, you know, being around people at that level of talent, like Ella Mrajnik, who you would just adore, our costume designer, she's like proper old New York. Like sometimes you try on a dress and she go, no, I'm sorry, that looks like puke. I have to say it looks like puke. And like she like the color, you'd be like, I just absolutely loved her so much. And she designed Showgirls and like Maleficent and The Greatest Showman. She's designing Cinderella with Billy Porter as the fairy godparent, which I'm very excited about. Incredible. But like being around those people and just think there's no one better than you at this. And then walking into the ballrooms and hundreds of supporting artists and actors and these costumes and the music. And oh, there was just many moments of pinch yourself. It just, yeah, kept coming.
They just kept on coming, honey. And like, what I find so interesting about the script in so many ways is it is obviously set in the Regency period, but there's still so many kind of like hang-ups around patriarchy that we're still having to fight today, right?
Hugely.
Like, for instance, the idea that women are made or broken on the marriage market in Bridgerton is still weirdly infiltrating into the world we still live in, which is still so reductive. Do you still find that very reductive, that kind of like how we view or balance women on their success of their relationships and things like that?
100%. It's funny because I think, you know, while filming, you go, oh my gosh, this is so archaic and it's so great we don't do this anymore. And then you think, how is dressing yourself up and going out to a ball to say, I'm single and available, any different to someone, you know, dressing up, taking pictures and putting them on Tinder and saying, I'm available? It's the same thing in a different package, really.
Mm.
And I think I found, especially with the character I play with Penelope and with her best friend Eloise, they are young women who are very much ahead of their time, but they're totally constrained by the society in which they live, in that they can't, you know, go and study, they can't go to university, they can't have their own money. You know, their money is their father's money, and then they essentially get sold to their husbands for a dowry. Then their husband takes control of all of their money. You know, they're basically baby making machines. That's their lot in life. But also, I think sometimes I come at it from like a really Western perspective, and I think that's still the case in a lot of places in the world. You know, there's so much pressure. The patriarchy, as you said, it not only puts pressure on women, but on the men as well. I think it's really interestingly explored in the show with Johnny Bailey's character, Anthony Bridgerton, how he's expected to be the sort of masculine ideal of, you know, the patriarch, the head of the house, all of this stuff. And he's really uncomfortable with that. And then Benedict Bridgerton, who, you know, also really doesn't conform to that patriarchal ideal and really struggles. And I think as much then as now, like, who is the patriarchy serving? Who's it helping out? Why do we have to adhere to these expectations? Couldn't we just be our own people and wouldn't we all be happier?
Oh my God, it's so true. And I mean, with that in mind, Shonda Rhimes is literally the queen of changing the landscape of TV and pushing it in a new direction. So it's not 100% in the male gaze, it's in the female gaze.
100%.
We're getting representation. How amazing was it to actually walk onto that set and actually feel like the world you were stepping onto almost reflected the world that you actually live in today.
It was phenomenal. It was absolutely phenomenal, because I think that's the thing that Shondaland have done. They've been so revolutionary, and I don't think sometimes they get enough credit for it, because they've changed the landscape of television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think back to when Grey's Anatomy started, it's nearly like 20 years old. And, you know, them, you know, having that amount of diversity on screen at that time was really revolutionary. And it's sad that so far it's still a revolutionary thing.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, Shondaland, like not just Shonda, but Chris Van Dusen, our showrunner, Betsy Beers, all of these people, they go, why can't we make this world? Why can't, you know, it's art. We're saying this is the world that could be. This is what we want to do. They're not really afraid to read the rule book and throw it out the window. Thankfully, you know, the success of the show has shown that people have a hunger for it. There's an appetite there. People have, you know, it's overdue. That's the thing. It's really overdue. But I would love, you know, if we got to continue going on to explore the queer characters more and, you know, explore all different facets of society. But I think, yeah, they're revolutionary in ways that they don't get enough credit for. Because I think, I wonder if a man had done it, they'd be like, what a genius. But Shonda's a known genius, but I feel like she should still get more props for what she does.
I mean, she is the definition of a queen, isn't she?
100%. Like, oh my God. But you know, the best things about all the Shondaland people is they are so down to earth.
Yeah.
They are so down to earth. I mean, I remember I met her in February in LA, but it was funny because I think you think of someone like Shonda Rhimes, like that name, like the most powerful woman in TV. Whoa, 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 whoa. And she sort of came out of her office and she was just super normal, super sweet, super friendly. You know, they're just like very no BS Shondaland, and they want to work with good people. And I think they're just, yeah, they're just awesome. They're just a flipping dream to work for, basically.
Plot spoiler.
Yeah.
It's the fucking dream.
Yes, it the is. Dream, pretty much, yeah.
And like, because obviously this podcast is all about being a queen and making reign over your own life, which is what you do, honey. But for you, who's kind of passed the crown onto you, would you say, and inspired you the most?
I mean, there's so many. I think a lot of the SNL women were really... really inspirational to me, like Amy Poehler, Tina Fey, Maya Rudolph, Kristen Wiig. Like, I sort of loved women that pushed boundaries and didn't maybe fit that. I never felt like I wanted to be an ingenue. I always felt like I wanted to be someone like who was characterful in the way that men were always allowed to be, and women were like, no, you have to sit in this pretty box and do this thing. I was like, that's just, I could never do that. I remember like trying to audition for like One Dimensional Girlfriend A in things, and I would always do terribly because I think, you know, probably something in my face just read, well, this is bullshit. this is not a proper part for a woman. And then it's funny because I'm not sure if I've said this to you before, but when I was like a little girl, I loved like Judy Garland, Bette Midler, Liza Minnelli, you know, everyone who I realized was not, I was like, oh, they were the gay icons. Okay. I didn't, like, you know, at 6 years old, I did not know that. But basically, I wanted to be a gay icon growing up. You know, I didn't want to be Cinderella. I wanted to be CeCe Bloom and Beaches. Like, those were the people, because they were just, like, strong and funny and strange. And that just appealed to me so much more than... yeah, being a pretty princess, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't get bigger gay icons than Julie Andrews, really. Stop. Let's get real.
I know.
And babe, I just need to plot spoiler here, if anyone hasn't watched the end of Bridgerton. Yes. Scroll to the second half, because we're going to have a quick dive into that ending, because babe, I remember watching Bridgerton when it just had green screens in the background, and it was like, I was obsessed. And I remember messaging you being like, oh my God, I can't believe this plot twist at the end, and I never saw it coming, in the fact that you are actually Lady Whistledown. So that actually technically means you are Julie Andrews. How's that feel?
It feels amazing. Because I think, you know, I've said to people, which is true, that I did cry when she got cast, but I couldn't, you know, for a long time say why I had the extra levels of freak out that I have. I was like, I am Julie Andrews. Julie is me. We are one and the same, and we are, and I am basically Regency Gossip Girl, and what? Oh my God. Because I mean, when I prepared for the audition, I had like, I think 1-2 days max with just the audition side. So I knew very little. I was like, I know I'm not going to read this whole series of 8 books within that 2 days. Let's just focus on this script. And if I get another audition, then I can do it. But then getting cast so quickly and unexpectedly, I was like, oh, damn, I better read these books and find out what this world is. So I started with book 4, which is Penelope's book, and then was reading it. And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. This is interesting. And then I was like, let's go on fan forums and just see what's going on here. Like, I just want to know a little bit more. And then on a fan forum, I literally read, when Penelope is revealed as Lady Whistledown, and I went, whoa, whoa, whoa. Excuse me? Because it's not like, oh, Shondaland have given me this great role in this great show. It's like, they've given me the role in this show. Oh my God. Like, it was insane. And then when I finally met with Chris, I was like, so am I her? Is it me? Is Whistledown me? Are we doing that? Is this happening? And he was like, yes, yeah, you are. So it was just, it was major, but it was so funny because it became like a real life secret that I've had to keep for like a really long time, you know? And sometimes on set, people were like, I wonder who Whistledown is. And I was like, do you want to know? I'm going to tell you who it is. I do know who it is. And I love to see people's faces.
Now I need to know, have you discussed it with Julie? Have you had a discussion?
Oh my God. So when we first met, it was like the very beginning of Bridgerton filming, and they kept saying, well, Julie might come to set next month and it might be this. So we were all like, oh. But I think it was like, you know, when you try and get children to behave, be like, Santa Claus is coming in a few weeks, so you better be good. So it just keeps you on your best behavior. I think Julie Andrews was our Santa Claus, that they were like, you know, just if you stay well behaved, Julie might come. But then I think also, because we finished filming just at the end of February, we were so lucky. It was like, yeah, just got it in pre-pandemic, pretty much. So I think we thought we had all the time in the world to meet her, and like, no big deal. And then now COVID life. And, I, you know, had we had a normal press tour, I think we would have got to meet her, but not yet. I mean, we will become best friends eventually. It will inevitably happen. We're both Lady Whistledown. So it's destiny. But I can't even, like, truly, it sounds so silly, but I can't even fathom the fact that she may know who I am.
Babe, she's technically playing you. I know. If you think about it that way around.
It's too much. It's too much to take in. It's too much.
Well, while we take that in, we're going to go to an ad break, babes. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about your journey to our screens, honey. So enjoy the ad break and we'll see you on the other side. Welcome back to Make It Rain. We're joined by the Derry Girls and Bridgerton Queen. It's Nicola Coughlan.
Oh, hello again.
Now, babe, I want to know, have you been able to watch Bridgerton with your mum? Because let's just say there's a lot of riding in it, isn't there? Have you been able to cope with that?
No. I mean, fair play to people that are like, you know, totally cool and their parents are like, I don't care, I can watch whatever. I am not that person.
Yeah.
I mean, just bearing in mind, I was in a show called Harlots, which my mum has never seen. I just was like, you just need to know I was in it and let that be enough for you.
Yeah.
No, there was basically, I had watched the series many times before it came out because I got obsessed with it. And I was like, I need to watch and watch and watch. And then, so I knew pretty well the, you know, how the episodes went and levels of sexiness therein. When I showed her the first episode and Johnny Bailey's bum arrives quite quickly into episode one, she told me off really badly. She was like, what's going on? I mean, yeah, no problem. It's just right out there. And I had to be like, it's not my fault. I didn't write it. And I was like, the romance novels, also, it's a really important part of the story. And then, but I was still in trouble. So then I kept going, oh my God, episode six is just nonstop shagging. What am I going to do? I'm in trouble. I said shagging on the Graham Norton show and I was like, I'm dead. I'm absolutely dead that I said that. I was literally like sweating when I watched back. I was like, I'm so dead. Also, she's like in her 70s, but she's now got a smartphone. So it means that she watches every inch you have ever done in my life. So if I say one naughty thing, I'm dead. So basically, I invited my sister over and I was like, we'll watch. I think we had 3 episodes left to watch. So we had 6, 7, and 8. And I was like, what we'll do, I'll be cooking dinner. You come in with me. We'll put on episode 6 for her. We'll let her watch it on her own. That's the awkwardness out of the way. And then we can go in and watch 7 and 8. And there's like a little bit, but it's not as intense as 6. So we'll be fine. She just refused to go in. She was like, I need to do this tidying up now. I need to do tidying up. And we were like, just go and sit down and watch it. And it just wouldn't happen. And there was just constant back and forth. So then we went in to watch episode 6. And my sister was sort of sat on the chair beside me. And she just kept going like, like, and whenever anything awkward happened. So basically what I ended up doing was just, and I kept saying to her, Mom, this is too sexy. I don't want to watch it with you. Like, I just don't want to. So I started just fast forwarding through all the sexy bits. And then at the end of the episode, she was like, that one was very short.
So she's not following the Duke Spoon account then?
The Duke Spoon. Oh, well, I have to say she's a Prince Friedrich stan. She just like has very specific ideas about who she likes. And she was like, now that prince is a much better choice than that Duke. And I was like, realistically, he probably is. Like, the Duke needs to go to therapy. No shame, but he's got to sort out what's going on with him. And yeah. Prince Friedrich is like a solid stand-up dude. So, but yeah, she kept going, I think Daphne's definitely going to marry the prince. And I was like, sure. I can't sure pretend that I'm not in the show and I don't know exactly what happens, but oh, yes.
Your mum just saw the crown jewels, didn't she? And she was like, I see why she should go for the prince.
No, she kept going on about his lovely kiss curl. She's like, isn't he lovely, that prince? Yeah. And she said, if we get season 2, she was like, you tell Chris, because she met our showrunner on set, so she's on first name terms. You tell Chris to get that prince back. And I was like, I will see what I can do. I will ask for Freddie Stroma's return if I have that power, which I don't, but I'll ask.
Oh my God, maybe we should ship Penelope and the prince together.
Oh, my mum does. My mum does. Hugely. And I was like, I don't think Penelope, like, no one wants to dance with Penelope, so I don't know why she would get a prince all of a sudden, but sure. Yeah, she was like, he's lovely, he's a lovely fella. And then every ball that happened, she said, and do you get to dance at this one? And I said, no. I said, Jesus Christ. Penelope gets one dance in the whole season.
Babes.
I know. Maybe, nightmare.
Maybe next season we have Penelope like slut dropping around the balls.
She's ready. I know. We need to get her drunk on some champagne and see. Might loosen her up, maybe.
Loosen up those buttons. Oh my God, they could do it to like the orchestral version of Buttons by Pussycat Dolls. That'd be stunning.
I love that. Yeah.
So Shonda Rhimes, if you're listening, can you please make this happen for us? Thanks very much.
Yeah, my mum would like more Prince Friedrich content. That's what we're all about. And she would like me to dance more. Those are her two requests.
What's so amazing, I think this is what's so amazing about you, from knowing and talking to you many times about your rise to the screen, basically, is like, you've been on, like, we're not using the X Factor term journey here, but you have been on a journey to get to this point, haven't you? There's been the highs, the lows, and we picked up a bit about this in the previous part of the episode. But how has that been for you, that story of literally, you know, the rejections, you going forwards and backwards? What has that story been like for you?
I mean, you know what? I think if you talked to me like 10 years ago, what was I doing 10 years ago? Jeez, I was applying back to drama school again. And I mean, that's why, I said to you earlier, I never want to understate the amount of rejection that happens, because it's not like you face it at the beginning of your career and then it completely ends and then everything's wonderful and you're just constant award ceremonies. Like, it's so not that in any way. Yeah. But, you know, it was really hard. And I think it's funny because looking back now, I wouldn't change anything. No. Whereas at the time, when you're very miserable and you're struggling and, you know, your dream seems... You sometimes feel ashamed of your dream in a way, because you go, it's so pie in the sky. It's so like, I didn't know a single person who was an actor growing up. I was like, that doesn't seem like a realistic career. These are people on the telly, but I don't know them. And could I be one of them? And what makes me think I could? So it is sort of embarrassing sometimes to go, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to be one of those people. But I think, as you said, it's a journey. It's not like... you reach the final destination, you're like, well, I've got this show now, I've made it. It's like just a constant ongoing thing. And I mean, I still have that fear that I'm gonna, you know, everything will finish and nothing will happen. And I think, but the fear is probably a very good motivator to work hard, you know. Maybe I should just always keep a little bit of fear in me.
In those times when you had the kind of like downturns, you know, when you were reapplying to drama school,
yeah,
and we spoke before about when you had to move back to Ireland because you were like in that situation. You went back to working in retail, and then you then had this amazing break, and you took yourself to London, auditioned for the play, and then you literally, then that was the trajectory for you, wasn't it, from there? But then even in that trajectory, there's so many ups and downs in that trajectory, right?
Completely. I think it's very easy to tell your story, quote unquote, and make it just seem like, and then it was this and this and this, and then it was all fine and wonderful. But that wasn't the case. Like, I think I felt like a huge failure a lot of the time. Moving to London at first, I felt like it just swallowed me up. I just couldn't manage it. I was like, well, clearly I can't live here. And, you know, you have to be super tough to live in London, and I haven't made a success. And, you know, I'm just working in retail. I'm not being an actor. This is rubbish. And I'm really broke, and I can't afford to hang out with my friends. This is not what I wanted to do. Because you've already gone through that, you know, applying to drama school, and that's so difficult. And there's so much rejection, and financially that's difficult too. You know, because I had to fly over and pay for all the auditions and accommodation and all that stuff. That's not easy to put that money together. But then, yeah, having to leave London that time, I felt like such a failure. I felt awful. I felt like the lowest of the low. And when you move back in with your parents, you know, I think I was 28 at the time. I thought, wow, I am nothing. I'm just absolutely nothing. I can't believe. And then you feel silly for, you know, wanting to do a career like that. And I thought, you know, I have an English degree. I could have just gone and done something sensible. And, you know, I have no money to my name. I can't afford to go get a coffee. I'm not a proper adult. I'm not, you know, it's awful. Because I think in times like that, your brain can be very cruel, and it can sort of, you can be your own worst enemy. Like, what's the good in telling yourself you're a loser? What's the good in being hard on yourself? There's no good in it. Very easy to say that now out of it, but at the time you can really beat yourself up. But I mean, that's one of the things that I'm sort of proudest of in my life, is that I was able to get out of that mind frame and that time. And it was really slow. It wasn't like I woke up one day and felt better, but it was just lots of little things. Like, I think I'm very lucky to have such a caring family, and that are so supportive, and that my sister that was like, get out of bed, we're doing this thing, we're doing this. And but I think it now, it makes me crazy grateful for getting to do what I get to do. Like, I arrive on set and I just am like, Jesus, I'm so lucky. I'm so, so lucky.
And you should be proud of yourself about, because I think I was thinking about this today actually, because I was thinking about your story and what you've been through, and like, at times when I felt like a failure personally, it feels quite lonely. Like, it can be the most isolating thing when you feel like a failure, doesn't it? What have those kind of periods taught you about the concept of loneliness and what being alone versus loneliness is?
Oh gosh, I think, I totally feel that too. And I think I definitely had times where I was like, why would anyone want to hang out with me? I'm boring. I have nothing to say. I'm not worth being around. And it's just like, you have to try and find the strength from somewhere to say, that's not true. That's not true. And it's like, you know, to just reach out to people, and it's okay. I think some people feel like, and I think I have as well, that there's shame in saying you're lonely, whereas there shouldn't be. There's nothing wrong with saying I need people around, and I think it's just, yeah, again, it's another lie that your brain can tell you, that you're like, oh, don't tell anyone that you need someone. Don't tell anyone you're lonely. Don't, you know. When I first moved to London, I was terribly lonely. And I think that's why now, if I go on a job or even go on a shoot or something, I just want to meet people and talk to them, because, you know, it's other human beings that will help you out of that and help. Like, that human connection is so vital. And I think we've found it this year as well, because we have been so isolated that we just need to reach out. And it's also, loneliness can be a really common thing. You'd be surprised at the people that you know that have suffered through it. And it's nothing to suffer through, because we shouldn't be ashamed of it.
Oh my God, we should never be ashamed of it. Like, I had, like, when I was in the first lockdown last year, I was like living on my own for like 12 weeks. And it was like, you have the moment when you're like, yeah, I'm going to do all the Zoom calls, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And then you have these moments of like crippling loneliness, and you feel really bad about it. But you're like, why do you feel bad about being lonely? Like, it's just acknowledgement that you need people, and that's okay too, right? Like,
100%.
It's, I don't know why loneliness becomes such like a derogatory term, and then it becomes something you take on, it becomes such a negative for you, right? Like, I don't understand it in your mind, how your mind does that.
It's so bizarre. It's really, really strange. And I always will say to people, you shouldn't ever feel bad about that. Like, we need one another. That's okay. Like, human beings or pack animals, that's all right to say that you need someone.
Do you think, given all those ups and downs we've just spoken about, do you think you wear your crown with pride now, sitting here today, Nicola?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I don't know. It's a funny thing. I think wearing a crown feels like such a big thing because I think I'm, it might sound totally contradictory, but I think I'm not actually someone who is super comfortable being the center of attention in a way, if that makes sense. I think because my, if I think back to when I was very little, for example, I think it was more so I loved to create and then show it off what I'd made and what I wanted to do. But then I would very happily retreat and be by myself. So I don't think it comes from me being like, da, 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 like, here I am.
But I personally think you should wear that crown with proud, honey. Like, you should. Okay. You should be proud of yourself. And you should be polishing up that crown morning, noon, and night. Make sure it's glittery and shiny.
I'll try.
We finish every episode with a couple of big questions, babe. So are you ready for some big crown jewel-esque questions?
I am ready. Let's do it.
So tell me about a time when you look back now that seemed like a negative, but in now looking at it, it seems like a positive.
Ooh. I always say to people, like breakups can be really, really tough, but I've never, if I ever look back in any breakup I ever had now, I do think, thank God. Because I think, you know, you're so much better on your own and happy than, you know, with someone that can drag you down, even if you don't realize it at the time. So I definitely look back on situations in the past where I thought I was happy or wanted to stay in this. And now I look back and go, thank God. Oh, my God. Thank God I'm where I am now and not in that situation anymore. Wouldn't have felt at the time, but I do now very much.
That's one of those things, though, where you're like, that's the best part of the breakup when you're like, Oh my God. Thank God I'm out of this situation.
I know. That's the one time I wish I had a time machine. You could go back if you're ever really sad and go, no, this is good. This is very good. I promise you, this is very good.
I love that. And finally, Nicola.
Yes.
In the reign of your life, what is the one rule you will always live by?
Oh, so I remember my mum, it's just a Shakespeare quote that I always butcher. It's from Hamlet, but it's to thine own self be true. I think you have to know who you are, know what you stand for, and know what your journey is without, you know, compromising yourself, and stay true to who you are as a person. And just, yeah, I feel like it encapsulates a lot of things. But yeah, just, she said it to me when I was like a teenager, but it just always stuck with me. And apologies to Mr. Shakespeare, have I butchered your quote? He may be a listener, so I just need to cover that.
Will's Bays, mega sorry if we butchered your quote.
Mega sauce.
Well, babe, it's been, honestly, every time I speak to you, it's just like radiant joy, like I could listen to you forever. And I just think you're super special and just keep making it rain. And I just love ya.
I love you. You're so lovely.
Thank you, babe.
Thank you, babe. Lots of love.
Thank you so much for listening, babes. I hope you enjoyed this conversation just as much as I have, and you're going to take so much away from it. And if you haven't already subscribed, make sure you subscribe or follow wherever you get your podcasts from so you'll know which amazing queen is joining me next time. And make sure you share this around your friends and get those conversations going, because we need each other more now than ever before. Hi babes, me again. Just wanted to tell you about something very exciting. I can't believe I'm about to tell you this, but I've written a book and it's called Great Chat. As you know, I love to chat, plot spoiler, and I love talking to people about their lives because, as I always say, talking and listening is so powerful.
The book is all about how you can master conversation and transform your life, just like it has for me. I've used my experience from all the amazing interviews I've been lucky enough to do, as well as a load of research to help you deal with everything from making new friends to embracing difficult discussions. Great chat should never be underestimated. It can truly improve your well-being, allow you to create the life you want, and bring the connections you are so deserving of, babes. You can pre-order Great Chat today in hardback, ebook, and audiobook, read by me, no less, and it's out on the 20th of June.